Hello, gang. Welcome to Sans. This is episode 9. This is for the newsletter that was for April 22nd, and we are behind. I mentioned this on TSB, where we're going to try and catch up, and we have been a little bit on the busy side with other committed things. This week will be our normal type of week where we'll have TSB, and we will also try and catch up sans and other things throughout the week, and hopefully by week's end we will be all caught up. I did see Friday's newsletter this past Friday. That'll be the 25th, and I have not even read it yet, so can't even comment on anything if I haven't read it. This is Sans News Bites, and it is recorded on April 28th, and this is annotated news update from the leader in information security, training, certification, and research. April 22nd, 2025, volume 27, number 31. And I write, welcome to Sans for April 22nd. Here's the table of contents for this newsletter. And for top of the news, we have Zoom remote control used in social engineered crypto theft. We have quite a bit to say about that one. We've got our second item, which is Cursor AI email bot invents irksome policy. Company apologizes. And our final item for top of the news, FBI warning. Scammers pretending to be IC3 are re-victimizing fraud victims. And I know that at least two of these items have been covered on the blog, and you can check that out at jaredtech.help. That's the short link that'll take you directly to the blog, where you can read all kinds of stuff, search things out, and link to other articles covering things that might be of interest to you. Here is the rest of the week's news. Japan's financial service agency warns of increase in fraudulent online securities transactions. Critical vulnerability in ASUS AI cloud routers. Cisco updates address 3 issues, including high severity WebEx vulnerability. Florida Senate will vote on bill opening E2EE upon subpoena. And they said quite a lot about that, but I'm going to leave it up to me to talk about my thoughts on this one. CyberSec CEO charged with violating Oklahoma's Computer Crimes Act for allegedly putting malware on hospital computer. Healthcare brief. Guam hospital pays fine for HIPAA violations, lab sues managed service provider, Change Healthcare faces another class action lawsuit, Microsoft Secure Future Initiative progress reports. All right, so lots of various things there, and I know that some of these were covered, some of them were not. Some of them were not so nicely covered by Sands themselves, and I don't remember if I have anything from the editors in here, but I will say this. Even if I don't, there are going to be a few items that I will comment on myself. And we'll just have to see how this goes. And as I said, we're playing catch up because I've not been available during my regular recording schedule as I've been involved in other things. And we're not too far behind. So hopefully we can try and catch up in the not too distant future here. Let's get going with top of the news. And one of these items I know we covered for sure, and this is the first item there from the table of contents. Zoom remote control used in social engineered crypto theft. The Security Alliance, in parentheses, SEAL, has published a security advisory warning of a social engineering campaign targeting cryptocurrency users that has already led to significant thefts. The campaign hinges on luring a target to Zoom and abusing the remote control functionality to install info stealers or remote access Trojan RET malware. So that's big. The threat actor, dubbed Elusive Comet, leverages a comprehensively established online appearance and social media presence to build credibility as Iranian capital, a supposed venture capital firm, and associated Iranian press and on-chain podcast. The attackers have also reportedly claimed to represent a Bloomberg crypto interview. The threat actor invites the target through X direct messages or email to participate in a podcast via Zoom call, engineering a balance of normalcy and urgency in the scheduling process. The threat actor prompts the victim to present their work by sharing their screen once on the call, and then uses Zoom's remote control feature to request control of the victim's computer. If the potential victim is not paying close attention, they may accidentally grant remote access, which allows Elusive Comment to install their malware to the victim's device. Seal provides indicators. Seal provides indicators of compromise, IOCs, including known social media profiles, and urges users and organizations to disable Zoom's remote control request functionality, which is on by default. And I'm just going to say this. I actually got a comment from one of our podcast listeners, although it may have been via a reply to the blog. And he says, I have been on Zoom before and have used screen sharing, but not the remote sharing, which I didn't know was there. So this is something of value, and yes, he did respond to the blog post. He may not listen to these programs. I will have to ask him if he has ended up listening to SANS, because this is huge. Nobody knows about this, at least not directly. And why Zoom would have such functionality when there are other tools out there that are supposed to do such a thing is beyond me. Although Zoom is like any other client, they want to get as many users on and they want to provide all of the various features in one place, such as screen sharing, remote access, voice control, and other things. I've been in Zoom meetings and I've never seen an option dealing with remote control. So if anybody knows anything about it, please contact me at tech, that's T-E-C-H, at MikeEchoNovemberVictorIndia.org. That's tech at menvi.org. And let me know what your thinking is and or where we can turn off the function, and I will make sure on another podcast, whether it's this one as a side note, the tech podcast, or TSB, that this gets addressed. Because the article that I linked to, and of course, each news item in here links to at least one different article that covers it. But there may be more than one in some cases where this is covered. But the one that I read that covered this one particular item did not tell me anything about how to disable this function. I'm not going to mention the person who commented because that's not important. But I do know those who participate on TSB on a regular basis, that being Nick Jackson and Preston Gaylor, also did not have any idea that Zoom Remote even existed. I'm going to have to go through Zoom settings next time I launch Zoom and see if I could find such a setting in its control panel of settings. And don't even ask me now how to go find it, because the only way that I know how to find it is to go into the Zoom Workplace application, which we'll do live. We would select the join a meeting. We would select the meeting ID from the list if we want, or enter another one. And then join it, and then as you're in the waiting room, you would select the settings for microphone and speakers, and then you could do it that way. Yeah, I don't see any other way to get at settings except for that. So, anybody have any ideas? Let me know. Cursor AI email bot invents irksome policy. Company apologizes. The AI chatbot and AI-powered code editor Cursor appears to have invented a policy that upset some users enough to cancel their subscriptions with the service. Last week, a developer using Cursor noticed that switching between devices immediately logged those devices out. The developer contacted Cursor support by email and received a reply from an agent named Sam saying that the logouts were expected behavior under a new company policy. However, the agent was a bot, and Cursor has no such policy. Cursor has apologized for the incident and says that any AI responses used for email support are now clearly labeled as such. This is not the first time AI has hallucinated a policy. In 2024, a Canadian tribunal rejected Air Canada's argument that the chatbot is a separate legal entity that is responsible for its own actions, and ordered Air Canada to abide by a refund policy the company's AI chatbot had invented. And yes, we covered that in the past, where Air Canada told a customer about a refund. They didn't get one, and they were told they needed to abide by that. And how is an AI chatbot going to know what's correct and what isn't unless you're fed the policies? And it knows the policies. If it doesn't know, of course it's going to make something up. This next one was also covered on the blog, and there may be also other items when we put out the show notes for this episode. And it is FBI warning, scammers pretending to be IC3 are re-victimizing fraud victims. The FBI has published a public service announcement warning of scammers pretending to be FBI Internet Crime Complaint Center IC3 employees. Between December 2023 and February 2025, the FBI received more than 100 reports of IC3 impersonation scams. The scammers have reached out to victims who have already lost money to scammers in a variety of ways. Phone calls, emails, social media, or online forums. They then claim, quote, to have recovered the victim's lost funds or offered to assist in recovering funds, end quote, but instead gain access to the victim's account information and steal from them again. You know what? I'm going to say this outright. And I know that I try to keep this podcast clean without any strong language or adult content, because we're actually taking from a newsletter, putting in our own comments, and calling it good. And as long as we link to Sands, I don't see that to be a problem. And if they don't like that, then they can definitely say, we don't want you doing that, and we will cease doing that. But I'm going to tell you guys what. If I were to get a call claiming to be from the IC3 telling me they recovered my money, I would more than likely send them an email confirming it. And I would make sure that I validated everything beforehand. And if I really wasn't sure, then I would hang up from the unsuspecting call, and I would more than likely call my local field office or the main FBI number and talk to the switchboard operator and tell them what number I got a call from, what they were claiming, and what do I have to do. So that is what I would do. If I could verify it by a phone call, great. And then if they did have my money, maybe instead of just giving them a bank account, I would just give them my PayPal address. You have my money? Send it to me through PayPal. This is my PayPal address. And have a nice day. But chances are you probably wouldn't be able to verify that by a phone call, because the FBI, like most major companies, don't call you unless you call them first. So how about that for size scammers? The rest of the week's news. Japan's financial service agency warns of increase in fraudulent online securities transactions. Japan's financial services agency, FSA, has published a warning regarding, quote, a sharp increase in the number of cases of unauthorized access and unauthorized trading, in parentheses, trading by third parties on internet trading services using stolen customer information, in parentheses, login IDs, passwords, etc., from fake websites, in parentheses, phishing sites, disguised as websites of real securities companies. Between February 1st and April 16th of this year, FSA recorded reports of 3,112 unauthorized accesses of securities firms, resulting in 1,454 fraudulent transactions. In all, a dozen securities companies reported fraudulent transactions totaling $350 million in sales and $315 million in purchases. And I'm just going to say this. If you can't tell that it's fake, it may not necessarily be your fault. Because as it's stated, this can happen to anyone. But it would be good for you to know who you're dealing with and the websites that you deal with on a regular basis. Let's say, for example, that you contacted the Music Education Network for the Visually Impaired in regards to services you need for you or your child, in regards to Braille music, large print, or any other adaptive situation. Now, because my Skype number is no longer available, the only major telephone number now is my Google Voice at 804-442-6975, or you may call the toll-free line and get assistance that way at 888-405-7524. When we call you back using the toll-free line, we are going to call from our long-distance number, which is 818-527-4754. Now, with that being said, our website at MenV is MikeEchoNovemberVictorIndia.org. As stated above, when we gave out our email address in one of the previous items in our podcast today. The Music Education Network for the Visually Impaired, as the company being represented herein, does not have any other TLDs that we own. We don't need them. I could technically buy .net and point it to .org, and I could, in theory, get .com if that ever became available and point it to .org, but I don't feel it's absolutely necessary. As far as the internet is concerned, anybody, anywhere in the world, can get to menv.org. And it was interesting about some of these emails that come to me telling me that I should, quote, buy the domain, end quote, because it matches what I have. One of the biggest ones recently was mensvis.com, which is already in a whole lot of trouble because it's already in a dispute, and I showed that in a recent blog post. And I love the fact that China wants to send me email telling me that they are, quote, holding menvi.org.cn, end quotes. But yet, I was actually able to go to GoDaddy and buy it if I really wanted it. But why am I going to buy a Chinese company domain in that TLD if I don't live there? I don't live in China, and I believe that I would have to have either a P.O. box or something in China to be able to buy a domain there. Just like for .us, you have to be a U.S. resident, and you have to show that address in your public records. So, all of what I'm trying to say is this. If anyone were to get any other email pretending to be Menvi and it didn't show my name or Richard's name, who also does email on the domain, then you want to be a little suspicious. Because normally when we send links, we will tell you what the link is for. Especially when we send out our journals and our rosters, even though the rosters are password protected. And of course, if anyone had any questions or problems downloading the file, which was password protected, we would send it to them by email upon request and or get them the link and explain to them what they need to do. We don't send links just to send them. And we don't send files just to send them. And as I was dealing with giving somebody some information to pay me, I asked if they want me to tell them that I'm attaching a file and what it's for. They said that'll work. The subject line should, you know, says it all. And I was there with the company at hand. But if I was doing it from home, you bet I would tell them what I was sending. So, that's how I do things. And I think if people start doing that, when they start attaching files or sending links, unless it's in a signature, then you should not be clicking on anything. Now, that's my opinion. People are going to do what they want. It's a free country. But don't come to me if you get an email claiming to be Menvi with a link telling you you need to install something to view things, because we don't do that. We send specific versions of files and let you decide what works best for you. And we tell you one's a PDF, one's a Word document, and one is, you know, a text file. And when we give you a link, it's usually to send space to go get copies of files, because we don't host them directly, especially when it comes to the roster. That has to be privatized and must be behind a password. Go figure. Critical vulnerability in Asus AI Cloud routers. Asus has released firmware updates to address a critical authentication bypass flaw affecting routers with the AI Cloud Remote Access feature enabled. The vulnerability can be triggered by a crafted request, potentially leading to unauthorized execution of functions. Asus has released firmware updates for 3.0.0.4 _ 382, 3.0.0.4 _ 386, 3.0.4 _ 388, so that's 3.0.0.4 _ 388, and 3.0.0.6 _ 102 series. Asus advises users who are unable to update right away to disable services that can be accessed from the internet. I say, go Asus, you're doing the right thing. And thank you for making sure that you are patching your stuff. Also, make sure that you are updating your customers by sending them a note or popping something up in their software, letting them know of this vulnerability. Cisco updates address three issues, including high-severity WebEx vulnerability. And by the way, WebEx is another conferencing client, just so that people understand what this is. It is web and telephone-based, if I remember correctly, but I know it's a conferencing client. It could be similar to Teams and Zoom. Cisco has published a security advisory disclosing a vulnerability in the WebEx video audio conferencing app on all operating systems, affecting version 44.6, fixed release 44.6.2.30589, and 44.7, fixed release 44.8 and later. 44.5 and earlier is not vulnerable. CVE 2025-20236, CVSS score 8.8 is an insufficient input validation flaw in the custom URL parser, allowing an unauthenticated remote attacker to execute arbitrary commands with the targeted user's privileges by persuading that user to click a meeting invite link and download arbitrary files. Users must update to a fixed version as there is no workarounds. At the same time, Cisco also released updates to address two medium severity vulnerabilities, one in the web-based management interface of Cisco Secure Network analytics, and a second in a Cisco Nexus dashboard. So I say again, go and get those updates. Cisco, make sure that you're letting your users know of these updates by popping something up on their dashboard when your program's open, and or notifying them by email, otherwise they'll never know. I think Software Today should do what Windows does, pull for updates. Cheesecake, a blind accessible program now only available to Mastodon unless you have a Twitter authentication key, can allow users to use Mastodon without a user interface for GUI. But the only reason why I'm also mentioning this is because when they do put out updates to fix bugs and introduce new features, the software will pop up a dialogue and it'll tell you that an update is available and will instruct you on how to go and get it. And that is what I like. This next story is one that everyone on SANS pretty much went completely ape on. This is the Florida Senate, and they will vote on bill opening E2EE upon subpoena. Draft bill SB 868, quote, social media use by minors, end quote, has passed committee votes and will soon reach the Florida State Senate floor, amending existing law to include an obligation by social media platforms to provide a mechanism to decrypt end-to-end encryption when law enforcement obtains a subpoena, as well as opening minor account holders' messages to their parents and guardians, and prohibiting minors' use of and access to disappearing message features. The Electronic Frontier Foundation urges senators to object the bill, stating in concert that other advocates, by weakening encrypted privacy, these changes further endanger those the bill aims to protect. This bill follows similar legislative initiatives in the UK and EU to break end-to-end encrypted communication on behalf of law enforcement. And I will also say that SOPA and PIPA were shot down for the same reason when they were adopted here in the United States, and it was not passed. There was a push by Demand Progress and other security experts, including Steve Gibson, that indicated at the time that this was exactly what they were trying to do here in the United States. With that being said, these lawmakers really do not have any idea on how this works. Your lawmaker has no idea how any of this works. And so that's the problem. How are you going to pass something that you may not understand? This is absolutely crazy. That is absolutely crazy. That is absolutely crazy. And I hope that the Florida idea is shot down just like SOPA and PIPA. And you will be able to read what Sands has to say in regards to all of this when this podcast is released, as there will be a link to this newsletter online for you to read. CyberSec CEO charged with violating Oklahoma's Computer Crimes Act for allegedly putting malware on hospital computer. Police in Oklahoma City have arrested Jeffrey Bowie, charging him with two counts of violating Oklahoma's Computer Crimes Act. Bowie, who is the CEO of a cybersecurity firm in Oklahoma, allegedly deliberately placed malware on a computer at SSM Health's St. Anthony Hospital in August 2024. While Bowie maintained he needed to use the computer while a family member was undergoing surgery at the hospital, security camera footage revealed that he attempted to enter several offices in the hospital and used two computers, one of which was for employees only. A forensic investigation revealed malware, in brackets, on one of the computers that was programmed to take screenshots every 20 seconds and transmit the images to an external IP address. Good job! Like, if I was at a hospital and a family member was in surgery, if I wasn't so scared of hospitals, I would be more concerned about whether my family member was going to make it out of there and or staying by their side if I could. If they were in surgery and I couldn't be there, I would be an appropriate citizen and either wait in the waiting room and or come back another day. Why in the hell would I be so stupid in taking the time to claim I needed to use a computer, install software onto a computer that could potentially be found out about, and try and pilfer data? That's what the CFAA is for. And this guy should be charged with that too. But see how Oklahoma's got a law too? I say, Good going, Oklahoma. Charge him with the book. Healthcare brief. Guam hospital pays fine for HIPAA violations. Lab sues managed service provider. Change Healthcare faces another class action lawsuit. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office for Civil Rights has reached a settlement with Guam Memorial Hospital Authority, GMHA, over a 2018 ransomware incident that affected personal information of 5,000 people and a subsequent discovery that in March 2023, former employees accessed the hospital's network after they were no longer employed there. GMHA will pay a fine of $25,000. Molecular Testing Labs, MTL, in Vancouver, Washington, is suing managed service provider and business associate entirety for failing to abide by the building's associate agreement the business associate agreement, including a failure to implement HIPAA safeguards. MGTL learned in mid-March that patient data had been compromised through a cyber attack against Entity, and this is N-T-I-R-E-T-Y, so Entirety. Is how I'm going to pronounce this one. If I'm wrong, somebody correct me. Fairview Health Services in Minnesota has failed a class action lawsuit against Change Healthcare. Well, they've probably failed one or filed one. Let's just double check that one. Filed. So they filed one. I got to learn how to read. Against Change Healthcare over the latter's ransomware 2024 attack. I wish I could be part of that lawsuit too, because, well, that's where Medicare and Medicaid patients' information is. The lawsuit seeks to recover $7 million in losses, much of which was incurred as a result of having been unable to bill for anesthesia services. And I agree. I mean, they failed to be updated, maybe? Maybe that's what I probably meant to say, but I gotta try and read what's there, and I'm reading faster than I can comprehend it. I tell you what, though, this is definitely turning pretty bad with a whole bunch of news in one item. The healthcare industry must learn that our data is of importance. Microsoft Secure Future Initiative Progress Report. Microsoft's most recent Secure Future Initiative, SFI, Progress Report details steps the company has taken toward improving, and that's in brackets, the ING, the security posture of Microsoft, their customers, and the industry at large. And I call bull, and I'll get to that in a minute. With the 28 objectives identified at SFI's outset nearly a year and a half ago, five are nearly complete and significant progress has been made on 11 more. The accomplishments recognized in the report include the launch of a Secure by Design toolkit for Microsoft developers that has been deployed to 22,000 employees. Phishing-resistant multi-factor authentication is being used on 92% of employee... productivity accounts and 100% of production system accounts and 90% of identity tokens from Microsoft Entra ID for Microsoft apps are validated using one standard identity SDK. And all of that is great. I don't see anything wrong with that. I think they should do the best they can to fix things. And other companies who have other issues should take this into account when continuing to make themselves better. The editorial board of Sans News Bites include Brian Honan, Kurt Dukes, Chris Elge, David Holzer, Ed Scoutis, Gal Spetzer, Jake Williams, Dr. Johannes Ulrich, John Pescator, Josh Wright, Kathy Bradford, Lance Spitzner, Lee Neely, Mark Weatherford, Moses Frost, Suzanne Vertronaut, William Hugh Murray. I'm Jared Reimer. I hope that everyone enjoyed Sans. I know that it's a little rough, and I know that I could do a lot better in making sure that we get everything out to you. And we'll be making sure that we do better. Sans News Bites is part of Sans Institute, 11200 Rockville Pike, Suite 200, North Bethesda, Maryland, 20352. You may contact me with comments by email or iMessage, JaredRimer at 986themix.com if you'd like to use that one. Or tech, that's TECH, at MENVI.org. That is going to be available to you as well. You can also text or WhatsApp 804-442-6975 or call the comment line at 888-405-7524. I know it was a little rough today. Lots of you know, mistakes, but I just need to slow down and take my time. With that being said, thanks for listening, and we'll see you again on another edition of the program. And don't be surprised if we have multiple this week as I try to catch up from last week. And we will be having another one on Tuesday. So this is last Tuesday's release. Again, I'm Jared Reimer saying thanks for listening. Make it a great day.